collection of poems was edited by Confucius himself. That was around the 5th century BCE. So it's from that text onwards, so Jaden has always had that association. So then the kind of a Jaden's material associated with intellectuals and literatis. So it's kind of often made into this kind of writing material. And then the Rotas, as Guido said, has this pure quality, but then that comes up very late, around the Song period. So that'd be around the 9th, 10th century. So Lotus require that kind of significance. So this is the 15th century objects. This is combining the two things together. And then the interesting thing about this little project, this object, is that it's kind of also inside it. You can see the pattern. So I was wondering that pattern could be something to do with tortoise. So inside it, you can see the pattern. So that also has some extra meaning in the Chinese context. It signifies longevity, and then also kind of you walk slowly, kind of steadily walking your way, all that kind of association. So it's kind of trying to pack a lot of meanings into these very little objects, and then you kind of put it in front of your desk, and then you see it every day, and you use it every day. It's kind of reminding you as kind of a Confucius gentleman. It's called Junzi. So that J is associated with that, the rotor is associated with that. And then that kind of turtles kind of signs. It's also reminding you kind of Taoist tradition here as well. So it's kind of packed up with meanings.
Do you want to say
anything
more on how it was handled, how it would be
dropping
the water into the ink,
etc.? Yeah, so it would come with kind of other three subjects at least in order to write something. So you needed a brush pen. The brush pen would be made of animal's hair, usually it would be wolf or sheep's hair, and then it's kind of the pen's body itself would be bamboo. Mm-hmm. So that's actually one, and then you would need an ink pot. So it is a very beautiful stone, could also be nicely carved. And then the third thing would be ink stone. So that would be the black thing, mm-hmm. that the ink color is coming from. So this number four object is this one. And then you pour water into, this one would hold the water, and then you would pour water into the ink pot. And then with that ink stick, you grind the ink out of it. And another ink is fresh, ready-made. So you can, usually kind of, you would be, if you're a gentleman, you would have a servant specialized doing that for you. And you could really kind of symbolically pour that little water into the pot. And then the rest job is done by somebody else. And it's right in there.
So the next object is this Japanese writing box, which is actually a desk once you open it. So it is in the form of a box, unfortunately. We cannot open it, neither is there an image of what it looks like opened. So we're going to have to trust the text on this. If you open it, it basically gives a kind of surface on which to write, as well as the compartments to keep the writing equipment in. It's early 19th century Japan made, but for the foreign market. So it's a typical design, sort of custom made based on European demand. So this is a lacquered box inlaid with mother of pearl, which is of the style called Nagasaki style. Sort of the historical development of this type of boxes is that originally they were produced in Japan, but towards the late 17th century, foreign merchants, when access to the Japanese market became more restricted, started importing sort of cheaper Chinese substitutes. But then by the late 18th century, in Deshima, which is the sort of small artificial island factory of the Dutch East India Company just off Nagasaki. This sort of production center emerged because there was so much demand from Europe, which was mediated by the Dutch East India Company. So that's the story here. So we see the branch of a maple tree with a bird on it. That's the design on the top, in mother of pearl. Sure.
The Dutch East India Company, by this period, was no more.
Yes, actually, that's a...
Who was trading for something like this?
That's actually a very good point. So, with the folding of the Dutch East India Company in 1799, actually the Dutch stayed on in several places. So in Japan, they actually retained their privileged access until the mid-18th century. It's only after the Meiji Restoration that actually this sort of relationship transforms. So after the ending of the East India Company, this kind of relationship that the Japanese used as kind of window into the West, it continued to be mediated by the Dutch. I think Miki maybe knows. So the next item, the small brass inkwell, it's from Khorasan, so it's from Iran, 12th century. And I think Sarah was able to say something about the decoration, right?
They changed they brought a new culture in the Iranian world, and we can see it through the kind of representation with the rounded faces and the costumes, and it's interesting also, this case is interesting because we can see the costume, and we can see they had bands of textiles on their sleeves with inscriptions on them, and we can see their bands of textiles. And yes, writing was very important in the Islamic world, and from this period, so this is from, we don't know the date exactly because it's not dated, but we can compare it to other examples which are from the end of the 12th century, beginning of the 13th century. And from this period we have also very beautiful pages of Quran, illuminated Qurans, and very beautiful pen boxes as well, with inscriptions on writings and on the power of words and beauty. So, yeah, that's quite interesting, yes.
I saw you in intense conversation over the translation of the word for pen, for the pen.
I'd reinforce a point that Sarah made, Sarah, about the writing. This is the pure, give or take, of the great poets, Rumi, Sa'di, Hafez, a little bit earlier is Firdawsi, putative author of the Shahnameh, the Book of Kings, the national story of the Iranian, of Iran and the Iranians. So writing is everything, all the imagery is listed in are terribly important. And if the dating is roughly correct, this is just a few decades before the trauma of the arrival of Hulegu and the siege and the subsequent destruction of Baghdad in 1258. The end of the line of caliphs get back to the Prophet Muhammad, which happens soon thereafter, which marks a fundamental shift in at least how the history of that part of the world was remembered, their sense of self away from the capital, Khorasan, Baghdad, that world of Iran, to, in the century that followed, Cairo, to Istanbul, to Delhi. So a real change in the geographical imagination. So this inquiry is from a moment which Islamic historians would call the very end of the late classical period.
It's really fascinating. It's a wonderful piece. Okay, shall we pass on?
I think what Gagan just said provides a very nice bridge to the next object, moving on in time as well as in geography. So the next object we're looking at is a mid-17th century writing box from northern India. So it's Mughal period and Mughal style. So it contains small departments for like pens and writing equipment as well. And very much as Gagan was explaining, by, you know, sort of the later Middle Ages, with like the rise of the Mughal Empire, you see a Central Asian dynasty with like Mongol origins, but also very much orientating themselves culturally on Persia, establishing their power in India, following several other Muslim dynasties coming from Central Asia who are doing that before them. So you see very much that this Persian sort of calligraphy and Persian sort of culture of poetry and culture of epistolography and writing becomes very much central to Mughal court culture. So I think this is an object that sort of symbolizes that. In terms of patterning, it's a floral pattern, leaves and flowers, which is said to be very distinctive of this 17th century Mughal period. So it's dated in the second quarter of the 17th century, so the reign of Shah Jahan.
If I can add something here, as soon as I get my glove unstuck. the style of floral patterning on this piece is really interesting because it's created at a time that is just on the cusp of the birth of the Mughal floral pattern, the standing flower with multiple blooms that becomes sort of the classic iconographic Mughal style. But what we see on the top of this casket is that flowers are still being shown within the dahlias, as well as some standing flowers in between the dahlias and some meandering foliage or sort of crawling flowers. And that shows a variety of influences. The flowers in the center of the dahlias can be traced back to the very earliest records we have. The standing flowers have a very well established history of being very much influenced by the arts of Persia, but also very much influenced by the botanical sciences of Europe and some European botanicals that have come into India and are circulating at court. And so we have sort of ancient Indian styles of floral patterning, Persian styles of floral patterning, and European styles of floral patterning that are all assimilated by the Mughals to create a new style, and that style ends up taking over the next 200 years from about the 1620s right through into the late 19th century.
That's fascinating. Really interesting.
Worth adding, this is the period of late Jahangir and much of Shah Jahan, who are considered the great patrons of Epicurean indulgences. And it's only from 1648 that the Mughal Empire gains a fixed capital in the form of Delhi and Shah Jahan. So before then, it's a mobile empire, Lahore, Baghdad. And so the fact that the place of origin is listed as either Delhi or Punjab makes a lot of sense.
So the textile fragments, which I think we all have spent most time marveling over, were excavated in the very beginning of the 20th century by an archaeologist called Mark Ornel Stein, who basically came upon this fortress, which is called Miran Fort, which was on like one of the oases of the Silk Road, and did a bit of a dig, came upon lots and lots of things, and then decided to return later and do like a proper excavation and unearthed all these materials, which are basically, we're looking at the sort of remains of an 8th century rubbish dump. It's like the kind of daily, the kind of quotidian materials that would have been discarded after use. So they include paper fragments as well as lots of different kind of textiles. So the paper fragments, some of them are inscribed with Chinese characters, so it's one of the ways how this offers us information beyond the material itself. And so this fort, Miran Fort, was actually established by the Tibetan Empire that was at that time, which I thought was quite amazing, stretching all the way from Bengal up into sort of quite far into what is now Western China, so Gansu province. And so this as well is really Northwest China, like Central Asia, on the Silk Road. So this is why it was a significant location to establish a fortress, to sort of establish a degree of control over this strategic route. Actually, so the textiles of this larger collection, which is called the Stein Collection after these archaeologists, they have a very wide date range. So the oldest of them are actually second century BC, and they go up till the 12th century AD. So they've found lots and lots of sort of remnants of, you know, a millennium and a half of activity on this site.
You should also perhaps just clarify podcast that not everything that is included in the science fiction is rubbish necessarily. There's also things that are believed to have been temple offerings or votive offerings, religious gifts, and the very high quality items. So in fact, science fiction does include some almost complete flags and a number of other objects that are not as big as what we're looking at today, as well as ceramic pieces.
Is there more that someone would like to say about the textiles, the dyes?
I'm just very fascinated by this tile. It kind of really gives sense of everyday life, really, because the breadth and the thinness, and kind of the threads and the color they're using. I was wondering what the person is making is a garment, kind of color this particle is. Because it's kind of all the things coming together, it's probably the person is making something. So it's kind of this tile particularly fascinating to me.
That little tile reminded me, I used to go to tailors to pick up their lashes. And it looks like the pile that the tailor has so the pieces. I think about that pile is what's struck everyone, right? It's just the most extraordinary, fiery, bright.
Kind of, the ceramic is extremely well, the red and the purple are extraordinary, and the yellow, the fact that the yellow is still there is very special. The red, I was saying earlier, might be a safflower red, which is that you typically find in East Asia. The special thing about safflower is that it can create either red or yellow dyes depending on how you prepare it, but the red doesn't last very long at all and always fades away very quickly. So this is quite fresh. It almost seems like it went into the dark shortly after being cut up and stayed there for centuries. It's quite phenomenal.
The quality of the sort of yellowish thread there, I mean, it just seems so soft and supple and beautiful.
One of the things that have been is quite useful in the Stein collection is that you not only see intersection of different kinds of materials from different regions of the world, you can also see patterns and how they translate over time to different regions. So, for instance, there are tiny bondi diamonds, a little hand-bound tie-dyed diamonds that you can find in paintings in China, on wall paintings used to decorate garments of monks. But that you find same pieces of that in the Stein collection made in such a way that they indicate the King of India, which means that tiny bondi pattern traveled all the way up and then was adopted by the culture of the region where the Stein collection came from. So much so that it became either imitated locally or became a necessity as part of what was being worn by people in that area. It's really interesting to see how we see not only a transfer of tools and materials and techniques, we also see a transfer of aesthetics through this time period.
Great. Well, thank you very much. We must pass on to the next one. It's time is passing. So
the last one is actually sort of the mystery object of them all, in the sense that very little information has been sort of made available about it. So if you look at its materials, I think the most striking, especially on the back and the sides, are these porcupine quills with which it is decorated. So this it's an ebony writing desk with ivory ornaments, and then it's a porcupine quills, I think, that really catch the attention. It comes from Visakhapatnam, so India, but actually it doesn't, or at least I haven't found any information about its maker or necessarily even a date, because it has been acquired by the Kensington Museum in 1879, but it came from the India Museum. So it comes to Britain through the East India Company, and it seems that that is what we know about provenance.
I can confirm that Britain is marinated to India. Close enough.
are what kind of bowls commonly used to decorate items in this region or in India? I just hadn't seen it before, so I found it very striking.
Do it. doing all this? Are we accumulating a whole series of individuals on the move? And John Paul has written about, said something about these individuals on the move. Are they faceless world talkers? Or we could ask, are they unusually cosmopolitan individuals? A category that Jan Fries has referred to in an article that will be published soon as the UCIs. So, unusually cosmopolitan individuals, does this make them very special? Is this what we're accumulating? What are we going to do with all of the evidence that we gather on these in bits of paper that we find in prize ships, such as Gagosun has explored? Correspondence from here, there, and everywhere? Does it add up to us saying more about an Indian Ocean world, a globally connected world? Where does it take us? So I'll just open a question like that. We looked at training encounters, we looked at empires, diplomacy, religion. Now we're looking at the evidence that we gather to say something about those other categories, that evidence which is, I mean, the nitty-gritty of the writing it down. There you are. Okay. Yes,
can
yes,
I start
yes,
by taking
yes.
you up on,
yes.
on Yannick's idea
yes.
of unusual cosmopolitan individuals?
Yes.
I mean, obviously, I don't know the way yet, as I can come in. But of course, if you talk about unusual individuals, the question then always is, well, what's the norm? And I always have the feeling, and we just had discussions along those lines in Oxford on Tuesday, I always have the feeling that we're conditioned to see sort of the people who stay at home and do not go abroad as the norm, which is very much, to me, a remnant of the 19th century view of the nation state, and you know, people stay within their borders. But what I like very much about Kapin's piece, for instance, is really this realization that actually this is much more normal. And maybe this is, they're not unusually cosmopolitan, at least not the letter writers that you looked at. Not the people that John Paul and everyone else in the research group are looking at. But there's sort of just a different kind of normal alongside people who stay at home, because both of them aren't just as normal as we as academics. You know, it's normal for us to travel around the world, whereas others might barely, you know, go across the channel. But I think, you know, that there's different, no matter, none of these things aren't necessarily exceptional.
But it is an interesting comparison, because you were saying how it's normal for academics to travel. But I think that's one of the criticisms that's been levied against this kind of work, is that those of us who do travel a lot are drawn to individuals in the past who we see similarly as border crossers. And then it's interesting that looking at people like Elias of Babylon, where so many of these globetrotters are people who are kind of writers, travel writers, administrators or clerks in some way, particularly when, you know, looking at a lot of the people circulating within the Islamic world. I think many of them are scribes or secretaries or munchis. So I just wonder whether that's something that we need to be conscious of and kind of work against, or whether it's something we embrace, the fact that we often identify with a lot of these people that we study, these individuals who we identify as cosmopolitan, I guess.
It's a wonderful point. I suppose, yes, there is a danger that we identify with these people more than sort of privileged in our scholarship. But I think, you know, I mean, there is a reason why we're studying people who have left written records, simply because these are the people that we can study. And, you know, having letters that were, for some reason, preserved because they were taken by pirates, for instance, I mean, these are sort of the exceptional cases which allow us to look at people in some different walks of life.
So I think we're at the mercy of historical record.
But yes, Gagan, because Gagan has, you know, upturned a whole set of records of all merchant classes, etc., at all different levels. And he could just say a bit more about these.
This is the challenge which I think all of us are aware of. The records of those who were not members of the conspicuous elite, kings and generals, etc., will, before industrial times, will, as a rule, be scanty and threat that that's just a reality. So, through these records, we can recover details, we can recover individual stories and the concerns vested in them, and in that History Today piece, its substance is basically two types of stories. First type of stories at the beginning are about individuals and their interactions at a very individual level. The second set of stories at the latter half are about these individuals in their larger context at a regional level. But they're still stories. So what meaning do they have? Why are they of interest to anyone who's not in that sub field is the fundamental challenge. And the only way that I've been able to come to some kind of answer to that is to develop a working heuristic model that does enough to fill the gaps and shore up the weaknesses, which are legion, in order to link them up, link up these stories and the specific, often very intimate concerns vested in them, to issues of broader concern. Be it to do with the fate of the continental Europe, or Eurasia as opposed to the maritime roots, the nature and function of the pre-industrial state, the matter of continuity or change between pre-colonial and post-colonial times, or the supposed purported 18th century general crisis across much of the Middle East and South Asia. Without a working heuristic model, which often will have to be quite bold, these remain details. And thus, bridging the micro and the micro will be something that can be easily dismissed by a critic who is not partial to what we are doing. And not that also. Publicize the book. The difference between the History Today essay and the book is that the book contains the heuristic model and the analysis building on, derived from these recovered details in order to recapture structures and solutions, and reconstruct structures and solutions, and then recover a set of dynamics that were the connective tissue of this regional world. That's the kind of approach I've had. Recovering details, reconstructing structures, and then recapturing the world.
Yeah. And Gagan, for the sake of the recording, could you give us the title of your book, where it's published, etc., and when?
It came out in 2016, published by Cambridge University Press, titled Indian and Islamic Heartlands, an 18th century world of circulation.
Who want to join this debate? I mean, this is, we've got a world of, religious figures like Elias of Babylon and John Paul's current George Romanus, the Archbishop of Samos, who are making these extensive journeys. We've got a world of these merchants. Are there others who are traveling like this? I am always looking for artisans because I'm interested in invention and how invention travels.
I think artisans, for instance, offer us another, it's another category of people that allows us to see how supposedly exceptional people could be drawn from very sort of perhaps mundane backgrounds. So a lot of a lot of people from Europe, for instance, found employment in India, bringing skills that were often of a military nature, being gunners, for instance, or sometimes of a, they had a medical background, they went as physicians, but a lot of these people were opportunistic, sort of, you know, perhaps maybe going out of some sort of adventurous spirit, but we can call them exceptional because perhaps they were a minority, but being a minority doesn't necessarily mean that you were rare. So I think this is where, you know, this kind of, it's a matter of nuance, I suppose, of definition. Are we speaking about exceptional people? Yes, but in a way, early modern people who wrote were exceptional within larger society, within society at large, right? So merchants as well. I mean, there were massive numbers of merchants, but the majority in most society were peasants. So in that sense, we're looking at exceptional groups, but it shouldn't be methodologically an issue because we can find substantial numbers of examples to make them representative of much wider trends. I think that's sort of my thinking here. And artisans are one of those groups of skilled people who could find employment, you know, beyond their sort of political or cultural context in which they were brought up, and it shows how a lot of these sort of borders were quite porous, and you know, people could find employment, sometimes of course against their will. I mean, Cecilia, for instance, your work of, you know, unfree people or captives. I mean, often a captive then, you know, made the best of the situation, and having their skills, they would have their chances to sort of make a career in another society. I think sort of a big question that I'm interested in to tie sort of the objects to, you know, the question of connected histories. We literally have been looking at objects that span Eurasia from the two extremes, right, England up to Japan, and pretty much most places between there. So I think maybe the sort of superficial likeness of these different writing cultures makes you think that we can speak about some sort of Eurasian Eukumene. And I think, for instance, Gagan in your work, which is of course India and the Islamic world, but it shows that people from different religious and cultural backgrounds were sort of participating in a similar culture of correspondence. So in a way you can say, you know, that is the core of Eurasia. To what extent sort of are we able to extend that? And we know that on both of these edges, you know, it's like between the Islamic world and East Asia, like the Chinese world, there were a lot of circulations, as well as on the sort of other end, the Mediterranean end of Eurasia. Then the question, of course, is, so does it indeed offer us much to be thinking in terms of such sort of broad connections, or what Maxine said, perhaps do we sort of iron out the differences to an extent that, you know, the story becomes too maybe bland? But I suppose that the different writing cultures, the different sort of meanings that were given to, you know, epistolary sort of cultures and so on, they may have been different, but the sort of the structural similarities are quite profound. So you did have the merchant letters, the diplomatic letters, the sort of, you know, the different, the sort of the instruments of the letter as a concept itself, where sort of they had this potential to cross these different zones. So people could write a diplomatic letter from Portugal to Kotte or from England to Japan, and sort of, you know, maybe the interpretation about the materiality and how it was framed and stuff could be different, but the sort of the deeper issue of the structural similarity, I think, allows us to understand how these sort of exchanges became more sort of prominent across this very large geographical space.
I recently made a research on that letter written on a textile and a book written by a woman who was expelled from Japan from that in the early 17th century. And it was written on the textile because they prohibited the same communication of these Japanese expelled to Japan. Mm-hmm. So, but what was striking is the fact that they prohibited it because they seemed the power
metric in order to then begin the process of making comparisons across you. As large a scale as you care to consider as important. So, for example, uncertainties that are about risks that are calculable as opposed to acts of God is an important shared reality for the same technological regime. Another is the fact of plurality. Populations in the kind of politics we're talking about were plural and segmented. All these are different kinds of people in Eastern China compared to Central Europe, but still plural and segmented, which does then foster certain behavioral patterns that one can put into conversation. Because these policies were talking about commercialized, literate, and urban, with qualifications across at least the principal regions we're talking about. And when you start thinking in those terms, these objects, the fleeting details in these scanty records can then begin to offer up meanings beyond just their immediate localism.
Another framework in Atlas is it is very much the framework of comparative history. So we can go back to, indeed, it was one of the things I thought we should look at, and we should certainly look at it if you're going to go to the conference, read it again. The piece by Amy Stanley on, I can't remember the exact title of it, but it's basically about a servant in Japan. She had a correspondence with her brother. She was literate. Her brother was from a temple family. Well, she was from a temple family, so she had been educated. And she never leaves Japan, but she does travel within Japan. And it's just very interesting how Amy Stanley takes this category of, she deals with this category of gender, of women who were not traveling outside very frequently. Some we have the Elizabeth Marshes, etc., of the world, but she sets that in a comparative framework. So takes up all the issues that come up in that correspondence and compares it to the situation of women in similar positions. A lot of it is all from Europe, but she is also looking at other parts of the world where histories of domestic labor and servants have been written. So it's a comparative approach. And that is just as much a kind of, it's also a global approach to those who don't travel outside their communities. And we also, certainly Gagin's, the families that he discusses in his work, the women in those families, they are not traveling, but they're connected with other members of the family who are traveling.
Yeah, I think that's what I find so compelling about it, is because it's mobile individuals, but also it's people who are living in a mobile world, even while not necessarily mobile themselves, and aware of these different places and working within this framework, even if they may not. And I think those two side by side offers a really compelling way of thinking about what you describe as this arena of circulation. And I find that Amy Stanley article really interesting as well, because she looks at how this woman, even while in one place, is kind of subject to these global capitalist trends that are affecting people all around the world in a similar way. So I think that it's different ways of looking at it that don't always have to focus on these individuals who might go on really interesting journeys, but it's having these different approaches side by side, I think, that.
And the comparison also, your way it's also networked. So not only, she didn't leave Japan, but then she received all the information about fashion, not only from Tokyo, also from outside Japan coming in. But the information coming in is a network. So can we start thinking, I mean, we have been thinking about network.
But so, suppose she wore were made in Japan, the textiles were made in Japan.
So we can maybe think about the information network. So there's information network global wide. So like certain ideas about the beauty objects, this idea. Not necessarily the object itself travel, information travels through networks. And then micro and the global can link in the local area in another way. So the network can be very dense. It goes vertical, like horizontal, go out as well. So go vertical, you can link in the local area, I've seen the local. So that's how the Japanese woman, she's linking through global context. This kind of other understanding she was talking about in another way. And then these, not only information travel, also people and individual and objects travel. So those individual and objects travel through networks is the channel. So those channels, then they kind of created this network. This network can be very dense 8 times. So like Elias Abelo, he really, what am I reading it, I felt he was traveling through this existing Christian pilgrimage network, missionary network. And then the way he traveled from all the way from Babylon to into Mediterranean and then Venice and then into the rest of Europe. That is the existing network of traveling. So this kind of, not necessarily Christian, but some part of the existing European kind of internal traveling network. And then when he came to Spain and Portugal, he traveled through that imperial network to empire, to South America. So this kind of, I think the various networks is kind of really individuals and objects travel. And then even that, those individuals, they don't travel, those objects, they don't travel. They can still be affected by these network effects. So on top of individual and objects, perhaps network is kind of much more global in a sense. And then this network across time, it can be disrupted by various means. For example, the border may close. It's not that the individual cross the border, it's the border crossed this existing network, but they're not able to close it. Because I feel the, so this kind of, the, if we turn the other way around, that is the network never really broken. This global connection never broken, just getting more and more intense across several centuries, and to the modern time, 21st century. So you think about in China, this the first emperor, his tomb, contains these objects coming from Persia. So those network is already there in the first century. So it's kind of never, the first 7th century, those things continue to travel between China and Persia and vice versa. So I guess it's linked to other parts of the world as well.
But there are the ruptures, the breaks, like the closing of borders or the taking of a ship. And they are the episodes that create the evidence for us, because that's when the letters get taken or the objects are seized. And so, yes, I mean, we really have to look at the ruptures.
But I think also there's something that it's interesting thinking about some of the objects that we've looked at this session and previous sessions as well, from your perspective, and thinking about that. The kind of global memory that is inherent in locally produced objects, for example. I mean, we've looked at many things which in common, the box, the ivory box here is an example where it brings together different traditions, different cultural traditions, visual traditions, and we've seen in some of the other salons European imitations of porcelain. Now, those may have been produced in, say, the Netherlands, and never left the Netherlands, or at least until they came to Britain and ended up in the DNA, but they represent and they embody a memory of those networks, those global connections, because of what they were imitating. So I think there is, yes, I think we can look at the evidence that we have, as you say, from the local perspective, but with those
to thank Alan Fotheringham and Joe Norman from the V&A, Sara, who is here, and from Warwick, my great team of Vito, Amir Sperrin, and Joe Tierney, and we, you know, I couldn't put this all together without them. And it's really been great that we had Gavin Sue here today because we were reading his piece, and he's contributed a great deal to our discussions too. So thank you very much. And if anybody would like, I mean, maybe we could get a suggestion where we could all go for a drink after, or those who can. But thank you very much, Avalon, and thank you very much indeed. It's been great to come. So great.